Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
He adored New York City. He idolized it all out of proportion. He romanticized it all out of proportion. Better. To him, no matter what the season was, this was still a town that existed in black and white and pulsated to the great tunes of George Gershwin. Now let me start this over.
Like, they call it the Empire State, but I think that New York City is not an empire city, it's a phoenix city. It's a city that rises from its own ashes again and again and again.
Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
Public Enemy, Woody Allen, Rick Burns, Al Pacino, and from the Crane's New York Business Future of New York City Conference at the Grand Central Terminal Hyatt Hotel. It is a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show today. Good morning, everyone. This is a conference with about 1,000 people from many sectors of the New York economy. They have just heard a keynote address from Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. He said some very interesting and some provocative things. We'll tell you about them. We'll play some excerpts later. Seems like all 1,000 are now mingling, network, and exchanging business cards, and soon they're going to be doing that right in front of our broadcast table. So it's going to get kind of loud around here, but we will talk to some very interesting people here. Mayor Bloomberg will address the conference later. We also hope to hear from him. Our first guest is Mitchell Moss, co-moderator of the conference and an urban policy professor at NYU's Robert F. Wagner School of Public Service, and he is an optimist. Mitchell Moss, thanks for taking the time from your moderating duties, and thanks for joining us at the WNYC table.
I'm pleased to be here.
Jamie Dimon, he said, healing has begun. There are indicators. The interbank lending rate indicator, known as LIBOR, shows activity. He had record bond sales last month. Maybe you can translate that into lay terms. What does this actually mean if hundreds of thousands of people a month are still losing their jobs?
Well, Jamie Dimon was a boy from Bayside, and we're blessed that he is running J.P. Morgan Chase. It's too bad he's not running all the banks in America. But what he said is that the worst he felt with regard to banking is over because they have been able to recover from the worst days of the fall when you saw Lehman Brothers collapse and when you saw AIG had to be bailed out. And Dimon basically said, we have problems, but we're solving them, and he expects that Geithner and Summers to do even more.
Are you as optimistic as him? I mean, certainly his tone was, there are problems that need to be solved, but hey, everybody, not to worry. And yet what I hear from Washington is that there's maybe a $1 trillion, maybe a $2 trillion hole in the banks. Many other banks could go down still if they don't do this bad bank or some such structure to get the toxic debt off the bank's charts.
No, I think that anyone who is working today knows things are tough because people are being laid off. Yesterday, Macy's announced that they're laying off 7,000 people. And the other part, if you walk around any shopping mall, the malls are empty. Retailing, which is a huge employer for lots of low-income households, as well as an important part of our economy, is dead. I think that, and commercial development is also suffering from a credit crisis. So there are real problems that haven't been solved yet. But Dimon was basically talking about the long-term future and the idea that we at least are doing things, and he hopes more will be done.
I've been reading your recent articles, and you are an optimist. You think New York City is well positioned to weather this economic downturn. Tell me more.
Well, first of all, New York City is not like other cities. You know, we're much more of a renter than a homeowner city. So although there are foreclosures that are increasing in parts of southeastern Queens and parts of Staten Island. This is a city where more than half the people rent, and so we're not going to see the kind of foreclosures because we didn't have the massive overbuilding we had. There are obviously lots of condominiums on Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn and parts of Williamsburg, which are not going to be bought so quickly because of the credit crisis, but overwhelmingly, I think, we're now seeing a change in the economic ecology of Newark. It's a renter's market and not a seller's market. What makes New York so strong is twofold. One, I think our city is financially strong. It's not like the 1970s when New York really didn't have a good set of books and we didn't have the revenues to pay for it. And the second part is the city today has got enormous amount of resilience. We have other sectors that are growing, so that media and film production. Last year, there were over 200 days of film production in New York compared to 69 days in 1969. We had 9% growth there. Higher education is thriving. People want to come to school here. And, of course, the safety of New York, something which has improved by 30% under Mayor Bloomberg and Ray Kelly, is still one of the great magnets. People want to visit. They want to work. They want to live here. And safety is the key asset which makes New York different from all other cities in America.
But with all that and all those other economic sectors that you referred to, Wall Street, as you well know, is generating just 5% of the city's jobs, but 25%, 20 to 25% of tax revenues before the crisis because salaries and bonuses have just been so darn high in recent years. So if Wall Street is permanently shrinking, what kind of New York City will we have in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years?
Well, Wall Street always goes through these crises. We had the dot-com of 2000. We had the Milliken junk bonds of 1997. And they really, and Wall Street and securities run from about 180,000 to about 130,000 because it's so productive. They hire and they fire. And I think we have to be careful. Wall Street's very important to the state's revenue. It's very important to the city's revenue. But it's not New York City. And in many ways, Wall Street's never attracted the best and the brightest. It's attracted the roughest and the toughest.
Huh.
And I think that we're going to see people who are very smart not go to Wall Street. They're going to stay as physicists. They'll be teachers. They may start venture capital firms. This is not such a bad thing when you think of the long term. I think we were driving a lot of people into financial services, and that was a golden era. Profits were up. Hiring was up. And the truth is, the city is based on achievement, not money.
But Jamie Dimon was saying some of that, even though he's, you know, the big banker in the city, he was saying it's cyclical. Some of this problem is cyclical. That he said when I hope we hope to play this clip later, he said his daughter called him from college. Did you hear this part
right.
of the speech? He was glad to hear that his daughter at college was following the news. And he said, Daddy, what's the fiscal crisis, the financial crisis? And he said the financial crisis is something that comes around every 5 to 7 years. We had one in 2001. We had one in Asia in 1999. But my question is, is that too simplistic?
I think it's a little oversimplistic. Brian, this is more than a financial crisis because we're going to find out the consequences of previous shakeouts in Wall Street were often confined to Wall Street. Now it's affecting everyone. So that kids graduating from college today are going to find out there are no jobs. I don't think we're doing enough to allow them to delay the loan payments that they're going to have to start paying. This is much bigger than Wall Street because, in fact, what we did is we deregulated lending. We created instruments for borrowing and financing activities that had no regulation. We went through a long period, and it started with Fannie Mae, you know, encouraging home ownership without any down payment and without just giving mortgages out. That's been a huge crisis. And then we have, of course, the banks, which went in their own way. And much of this was unregulated. We have to realize that the SEC didn't do its job. Whatever its job was, it didn't do it.
Right. But I'm going to press this one more time because I've spoken to so many people who said, oh, the 70s fiscal crisis was bad, but that was just bad management of the city's books. So when things got put together, things could come back. You know, the 80s, we lost 400,000 jobs, but things could come back. This time, it's not coming back because Wall Street will never be what it was before. Do you disagree?
Well, I don't think we should look at what Wall Street will be. We have to look at what other sources of growth will be. One important difference between 1970s and now is that New York City lost population in the 70s. We went down by over 500,000 people. Now we're up since 2000. We've gone up by almost 250,000 people.
Population is good.
Population is good. And people are coming to New York because they see this is a place, even if you're unemployed here, it's a place to get good skills. It's a place to work in part-time. I think that it's very different than other eras. Wall Street is not the problem that we have to just focus on. We have to look at the idea of having other sources of growth. If we just focus on financial services, we're then going to repeat the past. That's why having new industries, much more important.
Michael Moss from NYU, co-moderator of the Cranes New York Business Future of New York conference taking place here at the Hyatt Hotel. And as I said, now that one of these major panels has ended, you can hear hundreds of people milling about near our booth. We hope they're enjoying their coffee. You wrote that New York will compete effectively in the financial sector against other financial capitals because we will have more regulation. Now, that's the opposite of what I usually hear from business people, which is that with more regulation since the WorldCom and Enron scandals, like the Sarbanes-Oxley law, that financial companies have fled New York, fled the New York Stock Exchange, to make London the new financial capital. But you say London is declining rapidly. What do you see?
Well, first of all, London is much worse than New York because London depends far more on financial services than New York does. Remember, over 3.5 million people work in New York. Financial services is, as you point out, less than 10%. In London, financial services is a bigger part, and they're moving out of London, going to other places. Second part I want to say, and I think it's very different. I think you're correct. You know, last year, Senator Schumer and others said we have to have less regulation to help New York. Regulation will make New York be a safe haven for money. All the new financial markets around the world, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Mumbai, are not going to be regulated. People are going to view New York as a place that's safe. We are only going to compete well because we are regulated. Let all the buccaneers go elsewhere. The good money will come here.
Safe because we are transparent
and
as a result of regulation?
Yes.
Is transparency the key?
Well, I think it's transparency, and I think it's knowing that we're going to have rules about what kind of securities are issued. And I think that one of the reasons why people will come to New York is because we will offer them the kind of regulatory environment that is transparent and one which offers stability. So there are going to be lots of financial markets around the world. New York's comparative edge is that it's safe and it's going to be regulated.
And Jamie Dimon in his speech, and this was very newsworthy to me coming from the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, said that investment banks like his should be regulated like traditional banks and that that would be good for the country.
Exactly. Of course, Jamie Dimon is saying this after many of the investment banks have closed down and changed themselves into bank holding companies.
Right.
But Dimon understood that regulation properly done
and they did
attracts
that,
money.
They did that after September 15th so that they could get the safety net of the federal government,
right.
Correct?
Yes, exactly.
But I guess that brings them into those kinds of regulations. Mm. But doesn't recent history show that money does flee to unregulated venues? Because isn't that exactly what happened with these complex securitization of mortgages and everything? People went where it was not transparent. People went where they thought they could be cowboys and make a lot of money, specifically because those sectors were unregulated.
I think we're seeing a cultural shift in where people put their money. I think that's the reason why there's been money flowing out of the stock market into guaranteed areas of security. I think there's a genuine change in our culture about what's the willingness that people have for risk.
All right. Government. Michael Goodwin had an interesting column in the Daily News on Sunday, and he'll be on the show Thursday to talk about it. He suggests the Obama and Bloomberg governments are working at cross purposes, that Obama is cutting middle class taxes and preparing to hire people with federal jobs programs. Bloomberg is raising middle-class taxes, the property tax and the sales tax, and threatening to lay off 14,000 teachers and thousands of other middle-class city workers. Is that incoherent when seen as a whole, the feds and the local government?
The federal government and the local government have totally different kinds of rules they live by and totally different responsibilities. The federal government doesn't have to have a balanced budget. In fact, it never has a balanced budget in recent years. New York City, by law, must have a balanced budget. That means we have to have enough revenue to pay for services. Quality of life is essential to keep New York strong, and that's why we have to have taxes.
So one follow-up on that. Maybe now is the time for city and the state to go into debt, more debt, as a humane act, as an economic stimulus, keeping public services servants employed and services like education flowing, in addition to whatever taxes. This was suggested to me on the air by a union leader yesterday.
Well,
is debt now an act of humanity?
Well, the problem, the union leader should know, I wish he had taken my course, that there's a limit about how much debt New York City can issue. And that limit is based on a rolling version of the property tax. So debt may be something that is attractive to the union leader, but the city has a constitutional limit on how much it can borrow.
Mitchell Moss from the NYU Wagner School of Public Service. What are you moderating later?
A panel on media and information industries.
Topic close to my heart. We'll come back and talk about it another time.
Thank you
very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Cranes New York Business Future of New York City Conference. We'll talk to the CEO of Con Edison next in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC at the Cranes New York Business Future of New York City Conference today at the Hyatt at Grand Central. Kevin Burke, the CEO of Con Edison, is with me now. Mr. Burke, thanks so much for coming to the WNYC table.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for covering this important conference live. It's very important to the city of New York and to the future of the city.
As a public utility with essentially a monopoly, are you immune from the recession or from a shrinking Wall Street?
Not at all. I mean, we're affected. All of our customers are affected. We have many residential customers who are clearly being affected. Our commercial customers are being affected. You know, it affects us, too. And what we're trying to do is see what we can do to help our customers save energy, reduce their costs. And if they have some problems paying us, we'll help address those issues, too.
I see that Citigroup, I think it was just last month, ranked Con Ed a stock to buy. You had a less profitable fourth quarter in 2008 by about 25% from the year before, but you still posted profits of about 60 cents a share. Everyone probably wishes they had that business model right now.
Well, the utilities tend to be a little bit more stable than many other companies. Many other companies have, higher ups and lower downs. Utilities tend to be more stable, but we are still affected by the economy, as our customers are.
This is the future of New York City Conference. What's the future of energy in New York City as Con Ed sees it?
I think there's a great future for energy as we see it. And one of the things we're giving to everybody at the conference today are some compact fluorescent bulbs. So here's one for you, Brian.
I'll take it home.
You should take it home.
How many talk show hosts does it take to screw in a light bulb? We will find out.
Only one, I think. It's very important. And we've been working with our customers since before I got to the company in the early 70s to help them save electricity. And I think now that's even more important.
Why is it in Con Ed's interest to have people conserve energy? People might think that that's counterintuitive. Isn't it in your interest as a company to have your customers use more of your product?
I think it's in every organization's interest to have, their customers meet their needs. Just as with your business, it's the content of the radio show. With our customers, it's how bright is it? Is it warm enough? Is it cool enough? It's not how many kilowatt hours did I use today. Nobody's interested in the kilowatt hours. They're interested in the light. And with things like the compact fluorescent bulbs, people get more light, use less electricity, and save energy. It's in our interest because, as you know, in Manhattan, everything is underground. The streets are crowded. It's very expensive to do that. And in many cases, it's less expensive for us to help customers save energy than to actually build additional substations and put additional feeders in the street.
It's less expensive to have customers use less of your product than to build additional capacity to feed the product.
Right. So they save energy, it's good for the environment, and it's good for the apocalypse.
Now, what's the breakdown of sources for the power we get from Con Ed these days? How much from coal, nuclear, whatever?
Well, what most people don't realize is that Con Edison hardly generates any electricity at all anymore. We have a competitive market. You have options to buy your electricity from a lot of people. And over half...
But
half
you've
the
got a transmission monopoly, distribution monopoly,
transmission
right?
system. So we look at, who you're buying from. We'll deliver what, regardless of how it's generated. But in New York City, the vast majority of the electricity generated in New York City is from natural gas. Next would be from oil. Some is, transmitted from Indian Point. But actually, very little coal is generated, is burned around New York City. That's why the air is so much cleaner now than it was when we were growing up.
How different do you think that mix will be in 20 years?
I think in 20 years we'll see a lot more in terms of renewables, such as wind power. We're working on a project now with the Long Island Power Authority to evaluate, wind power projects off the south shore of Long Island.
Is that real, or is that just like what we think, we hope, will be the future of energy? Do you go home, do you go behind closed doors and you say, all this talk about renewable, it's all politically correct and everything like that, but it really can't generate that much juice?
I think it will generate a lot. It has to be handled properly, but it still can generate a lot, and I think it can reduce a lot of the air emissions in New York City. If you go back to to the 60s and the 70s in New York City, there was a lot of coal being burnt in apartment buildings, in schools. Most of buildings had the incinerators to burn their garbage. The air was pretty dirty then. The air is a lot cleaner now and will be a lot cleaner in the future.
We have a comment on our website from a listener who wants to know the future of the 14th Street plant.
The 14th Street plant is one of our cleanest plants. We recently refurbished that plant with a very clean facility. It burns virtually exclusively natural gas, which is the cleanest fuel that you can burn right now. And is our largest supplier of steam to our customers in New York City. When we provide steam to a building, they don't have to have their own, you know, boilers that don't get as much, you know, focus and attention as our larger, more efficient units.
And listeners, we can't take phone calls from the hotel here, but of course our comments page is open, and we'll be referencing your comments throughout this conference, throughout this program this morning from the Future of New York City Conference at the Hyatt. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. We have another couple of minutes with the CEO of Con Edison, Kevin Burke. New York now has a net metering law, meaning customers who generate more energy than they can use can sell it back to you. And I read that you now have probably the largest single net metering source in America, Big Sioux LLC in Crown Heights, with a 40-kilowatt solar array serving 925 Bergen Street and 1024 Dean Street. You familiar with that?
Yes, and I think it's a great idea. If there's a customer that's generating more electricity with solar power, not burning any fuel to use to generate the electricity that they need in their building, if they happen to be generating more, they just feed it back into our system. We distribute it to another customer. We get our electricity from so many sources. This is another great source.
And is that unique or a model for something more widespread, what's going on there on Bergen Street, Dean Street?
It's very rare, but I think it is a model. And I think New York State was one of the states that was out front in terms of net metering for, you know, people who can generate electricity with photovoltaics.
How else do you see Con Ed's role in fostering economic recovery for the city right now?
I think one of the important things that we do is we continue to invest in our infrastructure. The infrastructure is crucial to providing a reliable energy service to the city, not just during this time of, you know, tough economic conditions, but also when the city comes out and, you know, we start growing again. I think that's important. I think now is also a time to help people focus a little bit more on energy conservation and energy efficiency in terms of their products.
You mentioned at the beginning that one of the ways that you're affected is that so many of your customers are affected, obviously, if they're suffering during the recession. Do you have a plan in place to help people who are actually having their trouble paying their energy bills so that they don't get the lights shut off or that it doesn't contribute to getting them kicked out of their homes?
We have a number of plans. In some cases, we help them. We'll refer them to many organizations that will help them pay the federal government dramatically increase the HEAP grants, which are Home Energy Assistance Plan grants this year. We also have agreements that we have with customers where they pay off their old bills over time. You know, those are up dramatically this year, but we want to work with customers so that they can pay their bill and meet their needs and not have their electricity or gas turned off.
What else do you want people to know this morning?
I think that, you know, what we'd like people to do is, you know, I've given you a bulb. I'd like people to go out and, you know, look at that. You know, go to our website. You know, we're also giving people, you know, 10 tips to help you save, to go green and save, you know, on your energy. I think it's important that people, you know, take a look at what information we have, get this information out, look at how they can save electricity. It's good for their bottom line. It's good for the environment.
I'm going to take this 75-watt equivalent UB20 ESB energy-saving bulb with the ConEd.com and Energy New York logos on it and twist it into my favorite lamp tonight. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Kevin Burke, CEO of Con Edison. Brian Lehr on WNYC at the Crane's New York Business Future of New York City Conference today at the Hyatt Grand Central Hotel. My next guest is a certified genius of freelancing. Sarah Horowitz, president of the Freelancers Union, once won one of those MacArthur Genius Grants to pursue her work to ensure that freelancing isn't free. Her group has more than 60,000 members, last I saw, provides health insurance options and other support, and since unemployed people often call themselves freelancers, her ranks may be about to swell. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you.
How is the role of the Freelancers Union changing in the current economy?
You know, one of the things that we are seeing is that the rates of growth have just been incredibly high. And it's really highlighting the issues that people are facing always when they work independently, and that is episodic work. They're always looking for gigs and getting work, but what's happening now is that there are so many of them that we are realizing we have big holes in our unemployment system. They do not include independent workers. Independent contractors cannot get unemployment insurance. So we have to start thinking about now what is going to be the next safety net for freelancers. And not surprisingly, We're now at 100,000 members. We're the fourth largest union in New York State, and we're ready to start working with elected officials to start building the next safety net.
And I'll tell you that we get calls all the time from freelancers. First of all, we have a lot of freelance listeners at this time of day. And second of all, a lot of them are constantly frustrated, and people keep calling us. Not today, because we can't take phone calls from the Hyatt, but keep calling us with your freelance problems, because this is one of the big issues in a city of freelancers, of independent contractors, of people who are making their way in different, unusual ways. The safety net doesn't exist for them. So there's no place for them to get COBRA health insurance, for example. There's no place for them to get, you know, there's no equivalent of unemployment if you didn't have an employer.
Yeah, no, completely true. And that's what's really being highlighted now. So the Freelancers Union, which, if I can just say, it's at freelancersunion.org, we are providing health insurance, disability, life insurance. Soon we'll be having freelancer 401ks. But the point is that we model what the safety net is, and then there's an active role of government that has to come in and start talking about how are we going to encourage these kinds of organizations, not just in New York, but across the country. And interestingly, New York actually leads the way in terms of support for freelancers through our health insurance, but also elected officials are starting to get it. Almost every candidate that's running for mayor has come out saying that the unincorporated business tax is unfair for freelancers. They're starting to recognize these things. And that's not that it's going to be easy or we're going to get this done in 2 seconds, but the fact is we're a large constituency. We have a PAC. We're starting to really connect to elected officials. So we're ready to start building the safety net, and I think we'll do it.
How do you like the Obama stimulus bill from a freelance perspective?
Well, you know, it's a great question because, you know, I, as a citizen, really believe that it's wonderful to have an elected official who, you know, listens and hears and recognizes. And I think that what we're talking about is starting the next conversation. The current conversation is, given the things we know, for instance, the traditional unemployment system is having all sorts of problems, and that's where a lot of effort is going. But the next thing is saying, what will freelancers need? After all, freelancing is now a third of the workforce. This is the future. People are not going to go back to these jobs for 25 years. So I think that the next step that we'll certainly be talking about with the Obama administration is how do we get these kinds of proposals to be oriented to the future, and that is for freelancers.
So, for example, what about some of the health benefit provisions in the bill that passed the House, like subsidizing your COBRA policies by 65% for many laid-off workers? I realize that doesn't apply to freelancers until they become freelancers by
Although
being laid off.
Although we provide COBRA as well, but it just sort of makes sense because it's people's. We actually have the model of portability. You know, actually the
your health insurance.
Yeah,
plan.
Because it stays with the individual as the person goes from job to job. You know, many in D.C. are looking at the Freelancers Union as a national model. Just if you think about it, the benefits stay with the individual goes from job to job and project to project, but what we really need is a national financing system that every American should be able to get a level of health insurance because we're citizens and humans, and that then you could start imagining how we could start building upon that. So, yes, in the stimulus bill, I should probably let you ask that question, but hey, listen, I'm a multitasker. I'll do your job and mine.
You tell me what you have to say.
If you look at the stimulus bill, you can see that it's taking care of the existing problems. The next step has to be thinking about freelancers so that they're not connected to an employer.
So since Freelancers Union does run a health care plan, when the House bill would let millions of unemployed people enroll in Medicaid, is that competitive with the health insurance that you offer?
Well, typically, you know, they can enroll in Medicaid, but we're also looking at different kinds of income levels and whether people should be able to start not just in ours, but in plans that are already running. After all, we want to increase options. We want to build on what is already there, and those would be the kinds of things that you could imagine would make sense.
By the way, we've been asking people on our Facebook page, what's your five-word vision for the future of New York City? And here are some that have come in. More bicycles, fewer luxury condos. More trees, somebody did it in two words. More artists, fewer hedge funds. No more banks or drugstores. That may be a little extreme. You may actually want to deposit your money somewhere and go get some aspirin. More glass boxes. less jobs. Ha. Get drivers off the streets. More public, less private, and fewer Starbucks. So that's some of the stuff that's coming in on our Facebook page. Keep posting, folks, to that or to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show, your visions for the future of New York City. You've been getting some heat from your members for tracking them all away from your previous health insurance options you had to a plan run by your group that you acknowledge is more expensive. Do you want to talk to your members out there who may be disgruntled?
Yeah, I have to say we actually have five plans, and four out of the five were pretty much the same. What really is at heart here is that, understandably, we have to think about sustainability. We are a health insurance company that's a social purpose health insurance company, kind of like a cooperative or mutual aid in our structure. And that means that we have to be thinking about how can we take care of the current generation, future generations. And in our top plan, we had the rates that a normal insurance company would have just cut it right out, leaving people with no options. But we had to trim it and figure out ways that still left people in a difficult position. So the rates went up in benefits, but just for that one plan. But let me just say, over 95% of the people enrolled from one plan to our new insurance company. And with the new growth, we actually experienced no loss, which has been better than any year we have ever had. What it does go to show you, though, and the things that I really learned from that experience and what our members really made clear to me, was that their income is episodic. And every time we're raising the rates, or every time there's something like a coinsurance, meaning they have to share a percent of something unknown, it goes right to the heart of their unpredictability of income. And so as the executive director right now, I'm working on how can we redesign these plans. And that's why you want to have an organization delivering health insurance.
We have about 30 seconds left. Do you see freelancing spreading from certain sectors of the economy where it's traditional to new sectors as the economy is changing recently?
Yes. You know, in fact, I think that what's happening is freelancing is it's as it has been for the last few years. It is across the board. It is in manufacturing, surprisingly, finance, real estate, the arts, technology, health, nonprofit sector. The difference is
what's
we haven't recognized
between, what's the difference between freelancing and just being part-time?
Well, it's really being independent work, meaning that you're not connected to one employer in the long term in a full-time job. And that's how we attached benefits. That's why you see part-timers falling out of the safety net. Really, you know, what's happening is there's going to be very little difference between traditional work and freelance in the future, and that's what our elected officials have to start seeing.
Sarah Horowitz, president of the Freelancers Union, thanks a lot for stopping by the WNYC table at the Cranes New York Business Future of New York City Conference here at the Hyatt Grand Central Hotel. Brian Lehr on WNYC. We'll continue in a minute to talk about Silicon Alley, the future of tech in New York. Stay with us. Brian Lehr on WNYC, live from the Hyatt in Grand Central in the Cranes New York Business Future of New York City Conference. And there's a lot of talk about the hit that Wall Street is taking at the southern tip of Manhattan and the scary retail numbers from Macy's and elsewhere around the city. But tucked in between those two districts is called Silicon Alley, the so-called Silicon Alley, internet and new media companies clustered in Tribeca and Soho and spreading throughout the city. So let's talk now about how life is faring for those companies. Startup, somebody in the conference before called new companies upstarts. we'll still call them startups and standbys alike, and what role they have in the future of New York City. Kevin Ryan, do you know this name? He is chief executive of Alley Corporation, a network of six affiliated internet companies, including Alley Insider, which tracks all things Silicon Alley. He also runs sites devoted to luxury goods, music, and online shopping. Kevin, thanks so much for stopping by the WNYC table.
Thanks for having me.
A year ago on our show, we talked about how as the housing crisis was spreading and the stock market was beginning to melt, New York City tech companies were doing fairly well, with established companies like Google doing well alongside these upstarts and startups. What's the state of Silicon Alley today?
Well, everything is doing badly in the economy in the last 3 months, and so the Internet is impacted in the same way. But more fundamentally, I look at it over the last 12 years, and actually I think tech in New York is one of the big success stories. When we started DoubleClick in 96, we couldn't find anyone who had worked for startups. We couldn't find VC firms. There was very little infrastructure. Now there are hundreds and hundreds of companies that have been started, very successful ones, billions of dollars of value being created. At the time, Boston was considered more of an Internet and tech center on the East Coast than New York. Today, no one even makes that comparison because New York is really the undisputed leader on the East Coast.
Why?
Because we have the people. The most important thing when you do a startup is, you know, real estate's not that important because you're crammed in. You don't need that much. It's not like a big plant. You need smart people. And you need smart engineers, smart business people, and often you need access to other aspects of the economy. So that, you know, DoubleClick was in New York because the ad industry is in New York. I have a fashion company that's here because the fashion providers are here. I have a music company that needs to be in New York because the music industry is here. So it's location and people, and that's what drives it. And so New York is actually doing very, very well.
I know there's lots of talk about the video game industry, one industry that seems to continue to do well, even in this economy, gaining a foothold in New York. Do you see that as a realistic source of, you know, numerous jobs and revenue for the city in the long run?
Yeah, I think what you'll see here is in the entire Internet and tech industry, including video games, is that you'll have hundreds of companies that are anywhere from 5 to 200 employees. There won't be as many companies that have 10,000 employees, or that'll take 30 years to build. But you're seeing a lot of this. You know, I'll give you one example. At DoubleClick, we couldn't find anyone who'd worked for an Internet startup, yet now there are 10 people who worked for me at DoubleClick who are CEOs of companies, and 9 of them are in New York.
What's your core source of revenue then? Is it still venture capital investment? Is it ad revenue on existing sites? Where's the money coming from?
It depends on the business. So that, you know, some businesses like Alley Insider, it's a newspaper, so it's advertising supported. I have an e-commerce company, Gilt, that sells fashion online, so it's e-commerce. We're selling, you know, we'll do over $100 million in revenue this year in our second year. Involve another company that's a jobs company, which is a subscription model. So people are paying $20 a month to get access to great jobs. So it's either e-commerce, subscription, or advertising is really a source of revenue.
There's an ad recession going on right now all over the advertising industry, isn't there?
Yes, and that impacts all Internet companies, so it's going to be a much tougher year. Having said that, the share of market will continue to move online. There are more people watching TV shows online that they used to watch at their TV set. People are getting their news online. So the share of market is going online. So I think it's going to be a terrible year overall, but online is going to do better than offline.
And who's got venture capital anymore? Does it exist? Is it just sitting on the sidelines waiting for things to thaw? Does venture capital disappear when all this other money disappears?
So there's a difference. I find that later stage venture capital is much tighter right now. People are concerned, are you profitable yet? They're not willing to put that remaining $5 or $10 million in. They're just nervous. Early stage venture capital actually hasn't changed that much. Because think about it. If you are investing in a startup right now with two people, you're not expecting them to have real revenues, real profits for probably 3 years, could be 5 years. So the economic downturn isn't necessarily a problem for you as a VC.
And in fact, one of the uncommon economic indicators that we've gotten in that new project was somebody posting that he's got a blogosphere project, and he was proud and happy that he got venture capital just recently, right into the teeth of this. You're telling me maybe that's actually not so uncommon.
Absolutely. I've raised 2 rounds in the last 3 months of venture capital. So it's harder, but it's absolutely doable.
Where's the venture capital going? What are they interested in right now?
So I see in my space, and it's less a fundamental trend than it is they're looking for great situations. So, you know, I think outside of my sector, green tech is still getting a lot of money. There are lots of areas outside. But within my area, which is more Internet media, there are pockets. The job sector, online education, you know, in a recession, more people are going to be trying to find a job or nervous about the current job. They're going to be trying to get extra education, get back some nursing classes or a nighttime MBA. And they're trying to buy clothing at a discount. So things that take advantage of a downturn are doing great.
You know, I've read about talking Silicon Valley in California among venture capitalists there, that the focus in the Obama stimulus bill on traditional infrastructure and the so-called shovel-ready programs distracts from free market innovation on the part of high-tech companies. Do you see that as an issue?
Well, I think you have to add into that that there is about $20 billion in the Obama stimulus bill that's dedicated to health records online, which is essentially an online project with lots of different vendors that it has to still be defined. There's also billions and billions of dollars being devoted to infrastructure to increase broadband, and that's very positive for the Internet long term as well. So I think it's a big stimulus bill, and there's a lot of money in different categories, but I actually think high-tech is getting plenty of money.
Did you see that front-page article in the Times today questioning the stimulus spending for rural broadband infrastructure, saying they're not sure at all whether people are going to use it because we don't know how the customers would use the product? Are you that skeptical?
Not at all. I think if there's anything we've seen in the last 12 years is that when consumers get more bandwidth, they use it. You know, how many people have you run into just on a personal basis say, yeah, I've just stopped using the Internet. It's not very interesting. It just doesn't happen. People now watch TV shows. They do more and more things every day with more bandwidth. There's an insatiable demand.
I can't imagine how more broadband to people who don't have broadband would be a bad investment right at this time. But people are asking the question. Your site, last thing, Silicon Alley Insider, comes out with its annual Silicon Alley 100 list of powerful players. Any trends you're noticing among the movement on that list or other people we should know about?
Well, we've only done it for 2 years so far, so it's too hard to see a big trend there. But look, we're seeing more and more established VC firms that are in New York City. You know, it used to be, even 5 years ago, it was hard to raise money in New York. There were some firms, but most of them were in Boston. I'll tell you one fundamental trend now that we had to discuss for this list is that a lot of the VC firms in Boston are now putting people in New York because they're seeing more deals here. I'm working with one VC based in Boston. He has 6 of his 7 deals in New York City. That's where the action is, and that's great for New York.
Kevin Ryan is an optimist. It sounds like he's got reason to be about the tech sector in New York. He's chief executive of Alicorp. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Ryan Lehrer on WNYC from the Cranes New York Business Future of New York City Conference at the Hyatt at Grand Central. You can hear how it's become a lot quieter here all of a sudden as people have gone into their breakout sessions, which is good because joining me now is Jonathan Tisch. He's chairman and CEO of Loews Hotels, and we'll be able to talk to each other. We won't have to scream over everybody's coffee cups. He's co-chairman of the board of its parent company, the Loews Corporation. He also chairs the Business Travel Roundtable and is a member of the U.S. Department of Commerce Travel and Tourism Advisory Board. He's also the treasurer of the New York Giants, as some of you football fans know. I know you're trying to forget about how that season ended, but he's the author most recently of Chocolates on the Pillow Aren't Enough, Reinventing the Customer Experience. Jonathan Tisch, welcome.
Brian, good to see you.
You've been a strong advocate for travel as a way to repair the U.S.'s damaged international reputation. How do you think President Obama's election will affect travel to or tourism from the U.S.?
If you look at the challenges, and there certainly are many that this new administration faces, two of them can be directly dealt with an increase in international visitors. That's the economy and also the negative perception of the United States around the world. From an economic standpoint, you bring more people into our country, they spend the dollars that are badly needed, and they create jobs. When I was chairman of NYC & Company, which a job that I held for 6 years.
That was the Tourism Promotion Board of the city government.
Right. And last year we set a record, 2008, we had 47 million people visit our city. One statistic, of the 47 million people, only 18% were from international destinations, but they were responsible for 47% of the money that was spent. The international traveler stays longer and they spend more money. So by bringing in more international travelers, it will help the economy of this country. I also mentioned the diplomatic aspect, and certainly we know that we are not as loved as we used to be overseas. And I think the president now is seizing on that fact. It's something that he is focused on, certainly by putting Hillary Clinton, our senator, our former senator, in the role of Secretary of State. She's going to deal with this issue also. And our industry surveys show that when people leave this country, when they visited from other destinations, they have a much better opinion of us as a nation and as a people. So we think that travel and tourism can play a big role in some of the challenges we face as a country.
Mayor Bloomberg also wants to spend more money marketing the city as a tourist destination, but how much harder is the job of attracting visitors to the city going to be, at least in the near term, given that the euro and other international currencies are actually falling versus the dollar?
We really benefited the last couple of years from a weak U.S. dollar. And when you would walk up and down the streets, and I'm not just talking about Fifth Avenue or Broadway or Times Square, you really could go to all five boroughs and you would see a lot of people that didn't necessarily speak English and didn't live in the tri-state region. We need those travelers, as I just mentioned. It's going to get more difficult because the economies of the countries that are sending us these people are also in trouble. So the mayor, rightfully so, has really invested in tourism. He's invested in NYC and Company. He's allowed them to open 17 international offices, so it'll make it easier to spread the message about why people want to come to New York City. But he's also invested in the infrastructure of New York City to make it a more viable destination.
Maybe the best place for growing the tourism industry in the city right now is actually in the broader tri-state area, or at least in the Northeast in general. You know, another of the uncommon economic indicators that we got from a listener that was very interesting is from a guy who owns a little ski house up near Hunter Mountain in upstate New York. And he said his business this winter has been better than ever. And he thinks it's because the people who would have been going out to Aspen or wherever that's more exotic can't afford to do that anymore, but they're still traveling close to home.
There's actually a term for it in the industry now. It's called staycations. And what you're seeing is the propensity for people who want to go somewhere, but they don't have the dollars to go to Florida. They're certainly not going to Las Vegas. They're not going to Hawaii. Those destinations are hurting more than New York City is. And we got spoiled the last couple of years in New York City. Our business has been so strong, we've had the ability to raise rates much more rapidly than other destinations. So we'll end this year, and granted we're only in the third day of the month of February, but if we end the year at 82-83% occupancy, which will be down a good 10 or 12 points from previous years, that still is 20 points higher than the national average. And our rates are still strong. We have 77,000 hotel rooms. There are going to be 1,500 new rooms coming online. It will be harder to develop a new hotel, as you know, and certainly being discussed at this conference. There's no credit. There's no borrowing capacity for new construction. But that said, we have a great set of demand generators. The reasons that people want to come to New York are still here. It's the museums. It's the cultural attractions. It's shopping. It's the restaurants. It's Broadway.
By the way, did you hear the keynote address in the morning by the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon? He said there is credit. And I know other bankers are saying that, too, that people are lending. He gave some big number. I don't remember what it was, in loans that his bank has let out in the last few months. And I hear others saying this, too. Is the credit crunch a fiction or at least an exaggeration?
I'm sure there is credit. You're paying a lot for it. And the money is expensive right now because a lot of the credit is still frozen. And the banks are still working through these toxic loans. And they're still working through subprime. Yes, you can borrow money, but it's expensive money.
Mayor Bloomberg and City Council, as you know, just approved an increase in the hotel tax as one of the ways to get through this recession, up to 5.875% from a straight 5% per room, or about $3 a night on average. Were you not wild about this?
That's putting it mildly. The industry was vehemently against an increase in the tax. It was sending the wrong message at the wrong time. And when you look back to when the tax on a hotel room was almost 21% right before Giuliani became mayor, and then we as an industry working together with labor, working together with Broadway, with the restaurant community, we were able to repeal that tax. That one came out of Albany, not out of City Hall. The consumer today is very sophisticated. Yes, we have many reasons that they want to come to New York, but they don't have to come to New York. And if you increase the barriers to entry, taxation being one of those barriers, you're going to really send a message that is very much against what we need right now.
Do you think, though, that the consumer is that sophisticated? Is somebody sitting in Tokyo or London or Eastern Connecticut, for that matter, looking at where to go on vacation and saying, oh, the hotel tax is 5% in New York, but it's only 3% in wherever it is, or it just went up from 5% to 5.8%, that kind of incremental increase. Does anybody really notice that when making their plans?
They do notice it, and the reason that politicians like these travel taxes is because the theory is that you're taxing a person who can't vote. But the people that are losing their jobs can vote. And when you also look at the discussion now of increasing the sales tax, increasing the or putting in a tax on movie theater tickets, Broadway, restaurants, taxis, that is going to send a very negative message. And with the consumer already beat up, their 401k is shredded. They don't have as many dollars to spend on travel as they used to. Any reason that they can put off a trip, they're going to do it. And we feel that the taxation issue is one that they do focus on.
You've been very vocal in your support of an expanded Javits Center. And, of course, that whole West Side Stadium development that the mayor wanted didn't get approved. In our last 30 seconds, is Javits poised for future growth as a convention and tourism destination?
Unfortunately, I think we've missed the moment. And with the credit crunch that the state is facing, that the city is facing, the dollars are there. Part of the hotel tax is now going to renovate the building, so the private sector has committed their piece of the equity. But right now, I don't think there's any momentum or any will to go beyond just renovation and make the building what it used to be, clean, fix the ceiling that leaks, and make sure the heat works.
Jonathan Tisch is chairman of the Lowe's Corporation, and he is the author of Chocolates on the Pillow Aren't Enough, Reinventing the Customer Experience. Great to have you on the show. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
From the Crane's New York Business Future of New York City Conference at the Grand Central Terminal Hyatt Hotel, the special edition of The Brian Lehrer Show continues.